Well, I hope everyone is enjoying this beautiful weather we're having. Seems to me somewhere along about this time of the year, last year, we were doing the 100-degree weather and all of that. But it's just been absolutely beautiful the last few days. I hope you're really enjoying it. Tonight, I want us to take a look at a parable that we will look to in just a moment in Matthew chapter 13. If you want to go ahead and begin by turning there, we'll get to that. But we're going to examine what I consider the main point, at least, in the parable of the wheat and the tares. Been doing a little reading and just noticing how people used or have used this parable. It had quite a storied history, even in the formation of the laws of our own nation as far as the separation of church and state and all of that kind of thing. This references to this parable have been made by some very prominent and famous people. Not going to go all into all of that, but as I was doing some of that reading, I got to thinking about the parable itself. And I thought, you know, I haven't preached on that in quite a while, so I think I'm going to go to it and talk about it, and that's what we're doing tonight. In this parable in Matthew 13, I think it's obvious, it's a simple story. Jesus tells a story of a sower that has a field of wheat. And apparently an enemy comes along in the story and sows what is called tares. Tares probably refers, just based on the word in the original, probably refers to something that's called damel in the old terms. It was a ryegrass, so if you think of it in those terms. A ryegrass that looks, as you've probably heard many times before, looks very much like wheat. In fact, as they're growing through all of their different stages, you really can't, I mean, maybe the finest expert could, but you can't tell the difference between the two. It is only as you come to the harvest time, which made it a perfect choice to use in this parable, does the ear of wheat, as it's often called, or the grain at the top of the wheat appear, and obviously the ryegrass doesn't produce that. So you have to wait, as it were, to the harvest. It's something that grew and grows plentifully in the area of Palestine, so that made it likewise an obvious choice for Jesus to make. In fact, it was something that was so pervasive, that is, if it were sown in amongst the wheat, it would make it so difficult it would crowd out the growing of actual wheat, etc., and it made it very difficult to have a very productive yield, so the Romans even passed a law, because apparently a common thing, and I find this interesting, is if you wanted to take an act of vengeance on someone, if you wanted to get back at your neighbor, you waited till he had sown his field with wheat, and you went and sowed it with damel or ryegrass. And that made it very difficult. And so the Romans passed a law that, specifically against that, and had its own measures of punishment. So it's an interesting thing when you dig back into the history. And some even say, I have no expertise to know whether this is so or not, but some even say that it's very poisonous. That if you're not careful in the harvesting of it, if you harvest it together with the wheat, obviously you can end up making poisonous bread or whatever, so that would be a problem. But the great problem that you face, and I think that the story, as you look at it in Matthew 13, the great problem is no one wants such a weed, a pervasive weed like this, growing among their wheat. And it decreases the yield, etc. There are all kinds of problems that would grow out of it. And so obviously, you wouldn't want this, and Jesus then is showing that this is the action that's taken, obviously by the wicked enemy, as he describes him here, is the action that's taken that really messes up the field. And that's what we're going to take a look at in just a second. But as we look at this, and let's just go to Matthew 13, we can see the reasons why. Why the enemy would do what he's doing. So go to Matthew 13 and let's kind of set up the context, and I'm not going to get carried away with this, but you'll notice it's a series of parables where Jesus starts off with the parable of the sower. And I'll make reference to this a little later in the sermon. But we all know the parable of the story of the sower and that story where there are different kinds of soils representing different people and different kinds of hearts, if you will, etc.
And then as Jesus finishes that parable, he tells a couple of others. You see the parable of the mustard seed in verse 31. You see the parable of the leaven that many find very comparable to this parable in verse 33. And then in verse 34, he begins to talk about why he's using parables. And then he will come back, obviously, and talk about the parable of the wheat and the tares. And so we see this, or he'll explain the wheat and the tares. And so we see Jesus with a series of parables here, all of them talking about, if you'll notice, the kingdom. The kingdom is likened unto. It's likened unto, for example, verse 24, our parable. It's likened unto a man that sowed good seed in his field. Or it's likened unto, again, down in verse 31, a grain of mustard seed and so forth and so on. So he's talking about the kingdom. Now the obvious question is, what is the kingdom? What is the kingdom of heaven? And I believe if you look at Matthew and you examine it closely, a lot of people are inclined when they see kingdom of heaven to think in terms of heaven. Well, this parable obviously shows you he's not talking about heaven. There are no tares, as it were, in heaven. There are no people who are the weeds that are going to be separated from the wheat in heaven. When I'm talking about heaven, we're talking about the Lord's church. And I believe he's illustrating, and we'll read the parable to demonstrate this, but I believe Jesus is illustrating both the present nature of the kingdom, or the church, and the future reality of it. Let's read the parable together, beginning in verse 24. Another parable put he forth unto them, saying, the kingdom of heaven is likened unto a man that sowed good seed in his field. But while men slept, and we could even have a lesson just on that, but while men slept, his enemy came and sowed tares among the wheat and went his way. But when the blade was sprung up, that is, as the plants grow, and brought forth fruit, then appeared the tares also. So the servants of the householder, they came and said unto him, sir, didst thou sow good seed in thy field? From whence then has it tares? Where did the tares come from is the idea. He said unto them, an enemy has done this. The servant said unto him, wilt thou then that we go and gather them up? And he said, no, lest while you gather up the tares, you root up also the wheat with them. Let both of them grow together until the harvest. And in the time of harvest, I will say to the reapers, notice, I will say to the reapers, gather ye together first as the tares and bind them in bundles to burn them and gather the wheat into thy barn. Jesus went on to explain this parable. Drop down, if you will, with me to verse 36, as we mentioned a moment ago. When he sent the multitude away, the disciples came to him and said to him, declare unto us the parable of the tares in the field. Now, he'd already explained the parable of the sower, so likewise he explains this parable. He answered and said unto them, he that sows the good seed is the Son of Man, obviously himself. The field is the world. The good seed are the children of the kingdom, but the tares are the children of the wicked one. The enemy that sowed them is obviously the devil. The harvest is the end of the world, and the reapers are the angels. As therefore the tares are gathered and burned in the fire, so shall it be in the end of this world. The Son of Man shall send forth his angels, and they shall gather out of the kingdom. And I want you to notice that phrase, because I'm going to make a point about this in just a second. They shall gather out of his kingdom all things that offend, or all things that have fallen or stumbled, and those that do iniquity, and shall cast them into the furnace of fire. There will be wailing and gnashing of teeth. Then shall the righteous shine forth as the sun in the kingdom of their Father. Who has ears to hear, let him hear. Long time ago, when I became a member of the church, and as I heard this parable explained, I've heard it explained in numerous and different ways, as you read back over history and you see all the applications of it. One of the popular explanations is to focus on Jesus saying, the field is the world. And sometimes members of the church will focus on that, and what they will end up saying is, the field is the world, and within the world, there are Christians, obviously members of the church, and there's everybody else. But I think if you look closely at this parable, and I'm not going to spend the bulk of the time tonight on this, but I think if you look at Jesus' explanation, you can easily see, first of all, he started off by saying the kingdom of heaven is likened to. And then he goes on to explain it and say very carefully that the angels will be sent by the Son of Man, if you look down in verse 41, and they will gather out of the kingdom all those that offend and those that do iniquity. I believe Jesus is not focusing on the world in the sense that we commonly think of it, whole world, all the people in the world, as much as Jesus is focusing on the kingdom itself, that is to say, on his church. And one of the stark realities is that at the end of time, when Jesus comes in judgment, and this describes that very aptly, he'll come with all his angels and so forth. When Jesus comes in judgment, that's when Jesus will really differentiate, or we will see in mass, as it were. We will see Jesus differentiate between the sons of the evil one, or the wicked one, as you see here, and the sons of the kingdom, translated again in the King James as children. But the word is sons. And I believe it's used that way for a particular reason, because a son was the one who was an heir. And what you're talking about here is the idea of the heir of the wicked one as opposed to the heir of the kingdom, or what they will inherit. We're talking about judgment day. We're talking about the harvest in this parable. The primary lesson, and that's what we're really going to spend our time on for the remainder of time here, but the primary lesson in this parable is the difference between those who are genuine, those who are real, that is to say they are wheat, and obviously those who are not. They are weeds, they are tares, they're ryegrass. And the truth is, and I started to begin the lesson like this and decided that no, I wouldn't, but I will make the point. You know, Christians are often accused of being hypocrites. In fact, I don't know how many people, this happened to me recently, I'm talking about within the last 6 weeks or so, where I was trying to talk to someone, trying to encourage them, you know, as we often do, we have the cards and so forth, and we're trying to encourage people to come to church, trying to encourage them toward Bible study. And this individual began to say, like so many times, and I don't know how many times, but many over the last 30 plus years, the idea that I'm not coming to church, all those people are hypocrites. And it wasn't a reference just to this congregation. It was a reference to all churches and a reference to all Christians. They're all hypocrites. And, you know, this individual was just stressing that and was just being really nasty about it. Why should I? I'm just as good, the person said, as anybody down there. I'm just as much a Christian as anybody that goes to that church. Why should I go to church? And I do believe that there is a prevailing thought, at least among some people, that Christians, let me back up and say it like this, that churches are filled with hypocrites. And this may surprise you, and I want you to listen carefully, because if you don't, you're going to misunderstand what I'm saying. To a degree, they're right. Because their idea is that if you go to church, you should be a perfect individual. How many times have you had something like this said to you? I know I certainly have. In family situations or whatever it might be, you're supposed to be a Christian. And it might be at a moment when they're just really disagreeing with something that I'm doing or a stand I'm taking, and I might be right in that case. Or it might be when I'm having one of my less than stellar moments, you know. Maybe I've lost my temper. Maybe I got mad about something. Maybe I got upset about something. Maybe I'm in an argument. Maybe I've fallen, committed some sin, and you're supposed to be a Christian. You know, the truth is, Christians aren't perfect. And the truth is, every Christian at some point in his life will be a hypocrite. He will do something that he is not supposed to do. He will do what he says he doesn't do. He will be like no less than the Apostle Peter, whom the Bible says in Galatians 2, hypocritized himself. He became a hypocrite. So to a degree, they're right. This individual, there wasn't any point, so I didn't. But many times when people are saying something like that, I'll say to them, you're right. You're right. I've been a hypocrite plenty of times in my life. I've failed plenty of times. I've not lived up to what I said I am, what I said I'm supposed to be, what I said I'm going to be. And then I'll turn it on them and I'll say, But have you done that? Have you ever not lived up to what you consider yourself to be? And as I talk to some people, at least the more honest of the individual will say, you know, you're right. We all are. And my point is, being a Christian and being a member of the church doesn't mean you are perfect. And yet, at the same time, being a hypocrite from time to time, failing from time to time, not doing what you're supposed to do from time to time is not what Jesus is talking about here. Just because a stalk of wheat, and I won't go any further with the analogy, but just because a stalk of wheat has a flaw in it doesn't mean it's not a stalk of wheat. And that's what we are as Christians. On the other hand, a tare is a complete counterfeit. Satan sows tares within the church, complete counterfeits, godless individuals, people who are not Christians. He sows them there for the very reason that Jesus speaks of here. Because it's destructive. Because it hampers the good. Because the more tares you have within a congregation, when you read, for example, and I'm not going to do that, but those of you that come to the study in Revelation, when you look at the description of the churches in Revelation 2 and 3, think of how many of the churches Jesus addressed and pointed out that within the church there was the seed of Satan, for example. There were tares, is the point. And Jesus is saying in this parable that the enemy, the devil, sows tares among the wheat. He sows tares within the kingdom, within the church, so that it will stifle the growth. So that people out there can more easily make a charge. The church is, quote unquote, filled with hypocrites. So that it can be said that no one does what's right, etc. Because the appearance to the world is, it's just a field of tares. Now we know that's not so. But that's why Satan does it. I want us to look at the parable, though, and think about what Jesus is saying here. Because we tend, I'm convinced, that we tend to make it, let's say, more clear or clearer than it really is. Think about the way Jesus said it. Go back to the parable itself, beginning in verse 24, and drop down with me, if you will, especially to verse 27, when the servants of the householder, that would be fellow Christians, wouldn't it? When the servants of the householder came and said to him, "Sir, did you sow good seed in the field?" That'd be like you and me saying, "Aren't there only supposed to be Christians in this church? Real, genuine, faithful Christians. Aren't there supposed to be?" And he said, "An enemy sowed the tares." And so they immediately say, "Well, will you have us to run out there and basically clear the field?" We want to make it clearer sometimes than it really is. We want to say, you know, it's black and white. It's clear. One way, it's wheat and tares. And you can know the difference. We want to rush in like these Christians in this parable, or these servants, if you will, in the parable. We want to rush in and say, "Let's get rid of all the tares. You know, let's make it a point so we clean up the church." And I've even heard of people using that phrase. "So we clean up the church, clear out the chaff, clear out the tares, so we have only wheat in this place." We want it to be clearer than Jesus says is possible to be. In fact, what we want to do, and what we have done historically, is we've defined faithful and unfaithful. Sometimes faithful is the person that just comes to church. If you're here on Sunday morning, especially if you're here on Sunday night and Wednesday night, that's the faithful person. And yet, haven't you, those of you that have been here a long time, and I'm not even thinking of anybody in particular, but have you not ever known an individual that came to church and faithfully so, that ended up being an individual that was living a completely unfaithful lifestyle? We all have. Coming to church makes one faithful at coming to church. That doesn't mean that it's overall in a descriptive way of faithfulness. Jesus is saying it's not as clear as you want to sometimes make it. Faithful and unfaithful. It's not just the difference in coming to church or not. It's not just the difference in believing in the Lord's Supper and not having instrumental music or not. It's not the difference in, you know, whatever the organization of the church and the hierarchy that exists in certain denominations, and we don't have that and not. The point is, you can't boil it down to some simple criteria and say, that's the faithful person, that's the unfaithful. But that's what we want to do. We want to simplify it, oversimplify it, like Brother did 30 years ago or 40 years ago now, especially. Brother wanted to do over the whole institutional question. Who was faithful? What was a faithful church? What was not? Or go back 100 years beyond that. You know, when churches were dividing over instrumental music and the missionary society, a faithful congregation was one that didn't have the instrument. An unfaithful one was one that did. Well, inside the faithful church, they could have been doing anything under the sun besides instrumental music. Now, we want it to be clearer than Jesus says it really is. We seem to understand faithful and unfaithful based on some small amount of criteria, and that's not what Jesus is saying. So let's ask the question. If a tare is sown by Satan within the kingdom and is a true counterfeit, because that's what it is, a weed that looks like wheat till the harvest time, till the end of the world, as Jesus says it here. Till the end of time, it looks like a Christian. It looks like a stalk of wheat. Then what characterizes a tare? Really? Besides that limited criteria that we realize is too limited, what characterizes faithful and unfaithful? And what would you say? Would a faithful person, let's back it up and say it like this, would an unfaithful person be the person that's committing, you know, a sin and doing it continually? They are, quote unquote, living in the sin. They are the individual that is practicing a sin and practicing it virtually all the time. Is that unfaithful? And again, is it as simple as that? Can we look at someone and say, that individual, because they are now doing that thing right now and have been for X amount of time, is unfaithful? Well, what about the whole point we're doing this year? Is it more that we have to look further at the individual and say, is that individual struggling or willfully committed? I mean, look, the point is, we oversimplify. I don't believe God does. Are we looking at it as an apathetic approach? You know, they're here. They come all the time. They don't really care. There's no genuineness about them. They sit on the pew, you know. They go through the motions, as we commonly put it, but there's really nothing in their heart. Is that what it is? And if so, how do you always know that? God does. I know that. At every moment in time, God knows whether you or I is faithful and whether our name's in the book of life, and if He came right now, where we go. But can we know that? When we start talking about what's in a person's heart, I heard someone not too long ago say, I know what's in their heart. And I'm like, well, whoa, wait a minute. I understand that after a certain amount of time, and it's close contact over some period of time, yeah, you can know what's in someone's heart. I believe that. But I don't think it's any surface reading of an individual that tells you what's in their heart. Just because you see certain things doesn't mean you necessarily know the struggle or lack thereof that's going on in their heart. And so, what exactly is a counterfeit Christian? Is it, like we've said, a person that's embracing some false doctrine or some false practice? They're doing that, so it certainly makes them unfaithful as they practice that thing. But are they a tare, as Jesus talks about here? Again, I go back to the whole idea of where are they going? What are they doing? How do they look at themselves? You know, are they, as we touch upon our theme, are they gazing into the mirror and seeing need for change and beginning to struggle, at least, with the process of change? Or is it just the individual that does not care anymore? And maybe it comes down to as simple as that, but can I always know? I believe Jesus hits upon something in this parable that goes a lot deeper, maybe, than we sometimes want to believe. A counterfeit Christian, that is one that looks like a Christian, or talks like a Christian, you know, he acts like a Christian. When you meet them here on Sunday morning and you shake their hand, as far as you know, and everything they say and do, they are a Christian. They say the right things. They do the right things. They hang out with the right people. You know, and so we look at that person and we say, that's a Christian. They go to church, and maybe regularly so. Perhaps even away from the building. They pray and read their Bible and do certain things. Is that a person that is a Christian, or could we say there are actually people that look like a Christian, act like a Christian, etc., etc., and they are not Christians? Could we say that? A counterfeit Christian may even believe himself to be a Christian. I believe I've known people that sincerely believed they were Christians. But the truth is, they are not Christians. And so Jesus, when he talks about what's counterfeit here, I believe Jesus makes it clear that when you're dealing with dammel or ryegrass or whatever this is, you're dealing with something that's difficult. And I think that's the point here. It's difficult to see and to know if this individual is a wheat or a tare. And when we're talking about human beings, you know, a plant can only be what it is. A tare can only be a tare, a wheat can only be a wheat. But an individual, a human being, can change. And that's the difference. So how can we know? We are not Jesus. He can know. And we're not at His disposal to say of others, I know that one is a tare, gather him up and burn him. And the idea is in hell. We're just not there. We have to be extremely careful when we take it upon ourselves, and sometimes very arrogantly, to say, I know that person. Or as I quoted earlier, I know their heart. You better be very careful when you start trying to judge someone's heart. You know, the stark reality of this parable, go back to the passage Wes read, and let's look at it for a moment. Look at 1 Peter 4. I remember years ago, and it's been a long time, a lot of years ago, I can remember studying 1 Peter. And I remember coming to this passage, I guess, for the first time ever. I had been studying, naturally, chapter 3 and the whole idea of baptism at the end of chapter 3. And then, you know, when you first start Bible study and so forth, you kind of go ahead. And I got to chapter 4. And I remember reading verses 17 and 18 and how badly it bothered me. Because in all honesty, probably like a number of you, many of you, when I came into the Lord's church, I just naturally assumed, and wrongfully so, that every member of the church was a faithful Christian. That if there is one true body of Christ who truthfully, you know, tries to do everything according just as the New Testament says, well then this group, everybody in it, would be a faithful Christian. Now, that's how naive I was. And then you come to something like 1 Peter 4 and down in verse 17, and the Lord is saying the time has come that judgment must begin at the house of God. And then to emphasize that, he goes on to offer a couple of rhetorical questions. You heard Wes read them. And if it first began at us, members of the church, then, rhetorically speaking, what shall the end be of them that obey not the gospel of God? And we could compare that to 2 Thessalonians 1, where Paul does the same thing with the same type of rhetorical question, and it begs the answer, there is no hope for that individual. If the righteous, verse 18, are scarcely saved, and that doesn't mean just a very few of them, what that means is, with great difficulty, are the righteous saved. What it means, and think about Jesus' parable, when all of this separation is done at the end of time, it is then that the righteous shine forth as the sun. That's when you really see who righteous people are. In other words, the picture that you get in the parable and comparing it to what Peter is saying here is this. It's kind of like the world out there says, oh, the church is full of hypocrites. Well, you're right on two basis points. One, you are right that there are real hypocrites in the Lord's kingdom. If it were not so, Jesus would not be talking about tares. So you are right, and I can't dispute the fact that there really are hypocrites in the Lord's kingdom. And secondly, you are right that to a degree, every single one of us, and I don't care if you're a member of the church or not, every single one of us hypocritizes himself and falls short of living up to whatever standard we have, unless your standard is no standard at all. And even those people fail at that. So where does that bring us? Well, it brings us then to understanding that it is not easy to go to heaven. That I can't just break it down and say, I'm a genuine Christian. How do you know? And you may notice on your outline, this will be on page 2 of your outline under letter E. And I'm going to take a little bit out of order here, but this seems like a good place to bring this point up. That I can't just begin to say, I'm sure that I'm one of the wheat. Because. And you notice some of the things that I've got here. My parents say I am. My good, wonderful grandmother. We could never get past point number one. If Daddy said this is right, it's right. Well, just because my parents say something, and I believe anybody in here that's an adult will attest to the fact that you're not 100% right, even as a parent. I know Juliet was. No, the truth is, though, we all know that, don't we? And we all know that it comes to the point as an adult, I have to know what's right regardless of what my parents say. I honor them, I respect them, and they're right on many things. But as an adult, I'm held accountable to God and I have to do what I know is right. The preacher says, I'm a Christian. I'm inclined to say, well, what do I know? I'm still trying to understand it all, so don't listen to me when I'm giving my opinion, my judgment about something like that. You know, the truth is, there are a lot of things that preachers say that are not right. There are a whole lot of preachers out there that say those things. So, I can't base it on that. Somebody else says, I know I'm a Christian. I know that I'm one of the wheat. Why? And here's the one that gets me within the Lord's church. Because I was baptized. You know, I would suspect that most anyone in here that's a member of the church and been one for enough time would be inclined to say, once saved, always saved is not right. It's a point of Calvinism, whether you know that or not. It's a point of Calvinism, but you know people can backslide, as we heard a wonderful confession this morning. People can fall away. Once saved, always saved is certainly not right. But let me ask you a question. Do we believe once baptized, always saved? Sometimes members of the church act as though if a person is baptized, that's all they need to do. If I can just get so-and-so to be baptized, then that's it. That's what they need to do. I can feel good about them, et cetera, et cetera. I've been baptized. I can feel good about myself. But yet, when you look in the New Testament, being baptized doesn't make one a Christian, does it? I mean, it makes one initially a Christian, but it doesn't keep one or preserve one always as a Christian. Demas was baptized, but Demas was not a Christian. Hymenaeus, Philetus, people like that were baptized, they were not Christians, and a host of people that in our day and time, I'm sure everyone here can name. I have known people, I know plenty of people right now who have been baptized. Some of them are atheists. Many of them are denominational preachers. I know a host of people who have been baptized that are not Christians. In fact, it is almost, from my generation, it is almost like my good friend Cal Schlebach said to me, oh, you're still one of the faithful ones. And I understood why he said that. Because so many people in our generation are not. And many of them were preachers. So the point is, just because I've been baptized, or I'm a member of the church, even here at East Orange, That doesn't necessarily mean I'm a Christian. Joining a church doesn't make you a Christian. It doesn't make you one of the wheat, as Jesus is talking about it here. I read my Bible. How many people read their Bible out there in the world that are not Christians? I pray every day. I have known people. I know family members that read and pray every day. But does it make them one of the wheat? We might go on to say, a person might say, well, you know what, I lead prayer at church. I lead singing. I'm one of the leaders of the congregation. Whatever. Does that make you a Christian? Or can a person who's a real, actual hypocrite do those things? No, they can't. Just as much as they can walk up in a pulpit, just like I'm doing right now, and they can preach a sermon and preach it with all the decisiveness you can imagine, and they can still be a hypocrite. I've known them, and I know you have as well. Does that make you one of the wheat because you do that? Or we could go on and on with that. You know, I came forward. I went forward back whenever, and that makes me one of the wheat. It does if when you went forward and you announced you were changing and you asked for prayers, you did it. There are plenty of people who go forward out of guilt or whatever it might be, and there's no repentance whatsoever. Or a person might say, I know that I'm one of the weak. The story of the crucifixion. Someone actually said this to me, and not too long ago now, several months. But I know that I'm a Christian. I know that I'm genuine in my heart. Because the story of Christ, the crucifixion, moves me. It makes me cry. Well, there are all kinds of movies that make me cry. You know, I'm one of those people. I can hardly watch an emotional movie without booing, you know. But does that make me a genuine Christian? And on we could go. Are you a Christian? What makes you sure you are a Christian? What gives you real confidence? And you should have it. But what gives you confidence that you are one of the wheat when Jesus comes back? I want you to read a passage with me. And this is one we went over last night. On Wednesday night, several weeks back. But 2 Corinthians chapter 13. And I'm sure you know this passage is in here. This is a scary passage. But this is where Paul was saying to the Corinthians. Now be sure the Corinthians had their problems. A lot of them. But look with me, if you will, at the end of the book of 2 Corinthians, chapter 13, and go down to verse 5, when Paul said, God said through him, examine yourselves whether you be in the faith. Prove, test your own selves. Do you not know your own selves? And that's really scary to me, that a person can actually be walking around and not know themselves. Do you not know your own selves? How that Jesus Christ is in you, except you be reprobate. That's a scary verse to me. And I'll tell you why. First of all, it's written to members of the church. Many people would consider it impossible that you could write to a quote-unquote faithful church-going member of the church and actually suggest the possibility that individual would be reprobate. That is absolutely repudiated by God. And then, the second reason it bothers me so much is the way Paul keeps stressing here, and notice how many times really he's saying, as if to say, you really better get this point. One, examine yourself. Two, prove yourself or test yourself. Three, do you not know yourself? I mean, in one verse. Whenever an apostle piles up, not twice, but three times the same thing in one verse, you begin to understand this is a scary point. I could actually believe, be convinced, have all the confidence that I'm a Christian. I'm one of the wheat. Absolutely no possibility that I lack genuineness. And God be saying to me, are you sure? Do you really know? And then worse yet, God would be saying, based on what? What are you basing your faithfulness on. Let me conclude by suggesting to you what I consider to be a most dangerous situation. And this is going to sound like it goes against everything I preach, because honestly, I believe Jesus is the answer. I believe there is great benefit in coming to church. I'm out there all the time trying to get people to come to church more. I stress that. Any of you that have really spent any time with me, you know that. And yet at the same time, one of the greatest dangers that can happen is when you're around it, around church long enough. Either you grew up in it, and that's the case for some of you, or like me, you've just been around it for a long time. So much so that it's almost hard to remember, in one sense, at least how you felt, and who you were, what you were, like we were talking about this morning, before you became a member of the church. You know, it was a long time ago when I was baptized. It's coming up on 40 years. One of the great dangers is being around it so long, please listen to this, that you do fit in. I would suggest to you that if you've been here any length of time, most everybody in here has, if you've been a member of the church, especially when you've been a member of a local congregation long enough, it's comfortable. In fact, it's really comfortable. And you fit in. And you get this sense of belonging. I am one of them. I am just like them. I belong there. And you see what Jesus is talking about in Matthew 13 is, no, you don't. You're not one of them. You're growing up like a tare, like a weed. You might look like them, act like them, smell like them, but you're not one of them. And when I come back, I'm going to gather you out from among them and burn you up. It's a great danger because there is a sense of comfort that comes over you. It's like Paul saying earlier in 2 Corinthians, measuring themselves by themselves, etc., etc. When you start doing that, when you get to the point where you're taking a look around you and you are saying, like the guy I met not too long ago, I'm just as good as anybody down there. What is he doing? He's measuring himself by his perception of what he sees all members of the church being as hypocrites, so he's just as good, he's just as good a Christian as them. When did God ever say, measure yourself by everybody else around you? That's one of the greatest dangers as a Christian. That I can begin to be satisfied that I fit truth is, fitting in like a tare, growing alongside the wheat, just like they're growing, looking just like they do, etc., etc., is not good enough. It never has been. It never will. If you're here tonight and you're not a Christian, if you believe that Jesus is the Son of God, if tonight you'll confess that belief, you're willing to repent, to change, to make the changes that you see not in the people around you, but that you see in the Word of God. And you're willing to be baptized to have your sins washed away, you will be a Christian. You begin growing as a stalk of wheat that Jesus talked about. And maybe you look at yourself tonight and you say, yeah, there's a lot that's right with me, enough so that I can even be comfortable with that. And I can say to myself, I'm as good as anybody else. But I know deep down inside that God is saying it's got to be more. That's not enough. Maybe you look at yourself and you say, I need to come back to the Lord. I'd like for you to pray for me.